All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. How are you? How's your walk going? How are you doing with the dishes there? Is everything all right? Do you need help with that kid? Is that kid all right? Well, you know, just take a minute and calm him down. Calm that kid down. How's it going with the drive? All right? Be careful. Wear your fucking mask. Wear your fucking mask. Wear your fucking mask. Hey, Google, what is the definition of eschatology?
Here's the definition of eschatology. The part of theology concerned with death, judgment, and the final destiny of the soul and of humankind.
The soul end of humankind. She kind of swerved that. Google swerved that a little bit, didn't it? Hey, Google, what's the definition of a conspiracy?
Here's the definition of conspiracy. A secret plan by a group to do something unlawful or harmful.
Oh, but that's not a conspiracy theory. That seems to be what dictates the behavior of stupid people. The secret plan of a group, oh, those are the people that actually are generating the conspiracy theories for the stupid people. The creators of the stupid conspiracy theories are actually the conspiracy to make people more stupid, activate their anger, and to vote against their fucking personal interests and the interests of humanity so we get to get on with this eschaton. Today, by the way, I talked to Jim Carrey. Hey, Google, who is Jim Carrey?
According to Wikipedia, James Eugene Carrey is a Canadian-American actor, comedian, writer, producer, author, and artist. Known for his energetic slapstick performances, Carrey first gained recognition in 1990 after landing a recurring role in the American sketch comedy television series In Living Color.
Holy shit, I thought we were going to have a full conversation. Yeah, Jim Carrey's here, and it was not easy to get him on the show. I would have talked to him anytime, but it just never happened. And now, sometimes it's a little easier to get guests on with this new format. He's got a book out. It's an odd book. It's an interesting book that he co-wrote with a guy. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But the thing about Jim Carrey, is that... I don't know. He's one of those guys where, you know, I've watched him over the years and I always get this. I have a father who's prone towards depression and I have a sensitivity to it. So when I see people or I talk to people who have that sensitivity to it, it kind of gets, you know, I have to put up some extra boundaries. And it was an interesting conversation because he reminded me of something that I don't think about a lot, but it's a real thing. You know, he's a comedy store guy. And there was this, a very conscious, you know, for me, when you start doing stand-up, I guess that some people, I don't know how they really think about stand-up when they start it. You know, I'm going to tell some jokes. I've written some jokes. I'm going to tell them. But, you know, for some of us, the idea of getting up on that stage and figuring out who you are up there and what part of you lives up there and how are you going to be defined up there is a real journey, and that is the journey of the craft, the journey of the art, if you want to give it that. And what was interesting to me in this interview, if it doesn't pop as much as I think it should, because I found myself thinking about it afterwards, is that, you know, after Jim is already a very successful entertainer, he was an impressionist, and that's how he kind of got started. He goes back to the drawing board at the Comedy Store, and he decides he's not going to do impressions anymore so he can figure out, you know, who he is up there. And that's fucking bold, man. And that's what a lot of us did. You know, it's just like you keep going up there. It's not so much to figure out, you know, how to be funny, but it's to figure out, you know, what are you on that stage? Who lives up there? Which part are you? But by going up there with nothing and bombing and sometimes killing, but just having, you know, moments where you're not sure what's going to happen over and over again, he got to the character that really sort of defined him as a comedic actor. The I don't give a shit about anything guy, the I don't care guy, which you see in a lot of the work that he did later. And that happened on the stand-up stage. And I just found that fascinating, really, that's how he developed that. it's also odd that, you know, having not done stand-up in months now, I wasn't really missing it, but I think there's some other part of me that is missing it. You know, I feel like there's part of me that feels, you know, certainly, but this was happening before Lynn passed away, that, like, you know, is there more to do? Do I have to do more stand-up work? I feel like my last two specials, Too Real and End Times Fun, sort of sum up that's the big work, certainly for this period of history we're living in. And there was this feeling I had, was like, am I done? Do I need to do any more? And it's the same with acting. It's like, do I need to do more? Do I need to do more of other people's work? Have I challenged myself enough? And now, oh, my potatoes are ready. My potatoes are ready. Hey, Google. How long do you cook a baked potato?
Bake 1 hour or until skin feels crisp but flesh beneath feels soft.
Okay, all right. So what I was saying is that even before Lynn passed away, you know, I had this, you know, I was sort of blank slating a little bit, which is equivalent of creative flatlining. And now, like, I just don't know, you know, but I'm starting to feel that the part of me that lives on a stand-up stage is starved. And the other thing about, you know, being with Lynn for the time we were together, she was a great audience, and I kept that muscle working because she loved to laugh and I loved making her laugh. So it was always engaged, and I'm not sure what that muscle is like right now. I guess the point being is I do feel like I've done everything that I set out to do. I would have liked to have won one award. Do you know what I mean? Just one award of some kind. I know they don't mean anything, but one, you know, not, but like a big one, you know? Like, I would like to win a Grammy or a Peabody or an Emmy. It doesn't really fucking matter. It doesn't do anything, but I don't know. That'd be nice, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen for me. What's my big prize? A new kitten. Here's a new kitten. So listen, people, Jim Carrey's a force. You know him. You all know him. Everybody knows him. He was it. He was all of it. But he's co-wrote this interesting book. It's called Memoirs and Misinformation, a novel. It's kind of a novel, but it has bits and pieces of real stuff in it. And this guy, Dana Vachon, he can turn a phrase. He's got some funny in him. And Jim's, you know, there's parts of Jim's story and parts of it are fictionalized. But you can get that wherever you get your books. Again, Memoirs and Misinformation, a novel. And here's me and Jim coming right up. It's a day-to-day fight against sadness and anger, but I'm fine.
Yeah, I could offer you some help, actually. I think I could, actually.
Well, lay it on me.
We could talk about supplements. We could talk about tyrosine.
Tyrosine. I don't know that one.
Well, tyrosine is the chemical in your brain that's responsible for enthusiasm.
Oh.
Tyrosine. Hydroxytryptophan as well, which is what people who do ecstasy take on Sunday afternoon, so they don't kill themselves on Tuesday.
Oh, I see. So I get it. Helps them ease out.
That's right. Builds up the dopamine and serotonin again.
So those are well-prepared drug users. It's a full-time job.
Yeah. Oh, no, there are. There are some people who are up and down medicating themselves through life completely.
Oh, yeah. How about the microdosing people that don't realize they're just fucking tripping?
Oh, yeah. Tripping all the time.
Or the
people that are on Adderall, you know, they crush up the Adderall and snort it and stuff. And,
yeah. That's how the doctor prescribes it.
They get a ton of work done, but it's all bad.
Yeah.
Nothing good.
Yeah.
Nothing good.
So these are your supplements are, I'm on a very small supplement intake diet. I just take the liposomal vitamin C and a vitamin D right now. I'm anti-turmeric and I'm.
You look good.
I feel well.
Yeah, I've heard your turmeric rant. Yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah. I like your bits also about the shortening the distance or the time between
fuck you and I'm sorry.
Blowing up. Yeah. Fuck you and I'm sorry. That's really funny. And then taking the walk, winning the argument, and then looping back to apologize. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Very real.
You know how that goes.
I do. I have to apologize constantly.
Let's start with, we can start with the book and then move backward from there. It's like, I've read about a third of it. I'm trying, I got my own schedule, but I understand. I understand what's happening. No, it's got nothing to do with the book. It's just, my brain's in a weird place, but I'm trying to do my homework.
It's an incredible kind of thing that we're facing these days. Everybody is multitasking and I never stop. It's just literally, I took 10 minutes to take a breath before I got on the air here.
Well, yeah, but I'm just overwhelmed all the time. And, really, my ability to compartmentalize is limited. So
everything is changing so rapidly. It's unbelievable. We're in the midst of a convulsive historic moment.
Yes.
In so many ways at once.
Yes.
That it's just mind-boggling.
Are any of them good, Jim?
Yes. Honestly, I honestly believe that we are, it's the crowning of a new age. It's the crowning of a,
the birth.
We're going to get a, it's a birth. It's a painful labor. And I think, it's going to be a great new world,
Okay,
really
good. I'll hold on to that. So with the partnership in the book, now, did you have an idea before to write a book? And you were like, I imagine people have been pestering you to write a memoir for probably 3 decades.
I have no idea. I had no designs about it at all.
Right.
It really all came from a moment in time where I had stepped through the Truman door, which I've done several times in my life and try to kind of grow another branch that I could bring back to the tree.
Yeah.
I was spending time in New York in the West Village and becoming an artist, and
right.
trying to breathe life back into the West Village scene.
Yeah.
And I rented myself a space there and it was so much fun. And I was just, big bay door open and painting and going wild with music at 4 a.m. and dispatching drunks from the bar next door. And it was an incredible experience. And I was really deep into that in a really terrible winter. And, I wanted someone to give me kind of a perspective or maybe do an essay around the work I was doing. It was all fairly apocalyptic.
The paintings of popular, horrible people?
No, not that. That came later.
The
cartoons came. That was a symptom of the liar.
Right.
The cancer that we must remove.
The malignant pig man.
Yeah, the melanoma.
Yeah.
That belies a deeper sickness.
Yeah. I'll say.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Not an unfamiliar sickness though, is it?
No, it isn't, but it's reached epic proportions.
Yeah.
Since Gordon Gekko said greed is good.
Well, it's interesting. I was trying to do a joke, Jim, about how he's the envy of all narcissists because he actually succeeded in making it all about him. Actually everything.
Right. Everything. Well, yeah, there's a big danger there. So it's really tough not to concentrate on it.
Sure.
Not
so you're
take care of it.
So this is
so
before
I put
that
a lot of energy into trying to get that out of there. But before that, I was trying to meet a writer and maybe talk about an essay around the paintings. And Dana Vachon, who had no interest in that whatsoever.
Sure.
Was a really serious writer and didn't want to do essays about paintings.
Yeah.
He came in just under that guise to just meet me and say hello, because he had been watching me online and some of the ridiculous things I was doing were appealing to him, like something as simple as boing. I just got up one day and I tweeted out boing because I couldn't describe my joy in any other way. Have you ever felt the boing, man?
Sure. I sometimes
glimpses of the boing.
I usually fight the boing. I innately fight the boing.
Fight the boing that be.
Yeah.
Well, is that because you have a need to keep the well full, the pain well for your art?
I don't,
a lot of people believe that.
I mean, I've heard that, but like, I've never had to work to keep that well full.
Easy thing.
Well, no, it never dawned on me that people would do that on purpose. When people say
the rain gathers and the well gets full.
I'm just a joy makes me nervous, Jim. That's all. It just makes me nervous. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to behave around it. I end up crying.
I know, especially in this time, but in this time, it's like, it's almost like you're afraid to step out and be joyful. You're afraid to kind of affirm the positive and stuff. But I'm telling you, it's a big moment in our history, and it's a wonderful time to be barely alive.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's an exciting time.
From your fingertips.
And so Dana says he doesn't want to write essays about your paintings, but he enjoys your single word joy tweets, and that's where the romance
he
begins.
He came to meet me. He came to meet me, and we just struck up a friendship right away, and we kept talking. And we had kind of he's East Coast, I'm West Coast, so we had this Skype friendship happening, and the conversations got so interesting. I was doing a lot of viewing at a certain point. I was kind of hiding out from the world. I was going through a lot of deep currents in my life and
like
surviving.
What?
Oh, like major traumatic relationships and things like that that happened. So PTSD keeps me very selective at this point, and the atmosphere.
Do you feel like that you actually had PTSD from it?
Yeah, I definitely do. I've been through some things that made me jump at the slightest sound. Absolutely. And slightest hint of a relationship, I get a little terrified.
Yeah. Have you tried that EMDR?
Yes. I've done a little of that. Yeah.
I did a little of that.
Absolutely.
It was interesting.
It was interesting. It's a long process, though, going through every detail of a traumatic situation. You know, it's
to find the hot spot.
I recommend it. It's pretty interesting. Anything that lets you know yourself a little better, you know, and
I think
what's
that's
lurking
true.
In
I
there,
think
I think
true.
Is great.
Yeah.
Plus, it's good material. It's all good material.
Yeah. It can be. So, all right. So you're in that kind of you're running from the idea of a relationship.
I wanted to, and I think what happened is Dana and I had the same desire, and that was to study persona, what we're doing, why we're building these scaffoldings of, I'd call them, abstract scaffoldings of who we are. You know, I'm a Canadian American and I'm this and I'm that, and I'm a Catholic and I'm that, and it's all abstract stuff. And when you drill down, there's no you left.
If you get rid
of the abstract stuff.
Sure.
So that's kind of what tripped us into the Advaita Vedanta, which is the ancient Hindu structure of believing there's no two things, you know?
Yeah.
And so I really seek freedom that way. And the book kind of hints at that as the true identity. Is waiting for you when you claw your way out of the sarcophagus of the personality that you've created for yourself.
I used to say that most personalities are just a reaction from someone telling you you couldn't do something early on.
Yeah. Yeah. Or reactions to fear.
Yeah.
Reactions to the ego saying you're not going to have. It's like the book is about the fear of erasure, which we all have.
Right. Of course. Right.
You know, and our obsession with relevance, but not relevance that just makes you do all right in your life, the kind of relevance that lasts beyond your death to the end of the program.
But don't you think that this is something, you know, specifically relative to artists or people that with power that, you know,
I don't think anymore. I think the internet, the social media, everybody's begging a billion strangers to touch their subscribe button and open their notifications. And they're all trying to, you know, get to that place, which we got to. And but when we got there, we realized, okay, this isn't actually going to make me happy. You know, the transcendence of this at moments. I don't purport to be able to transcend this stuff and stay there. I don't believe anybody who does say that. Like, I'm just an enlightened being and I never feel anything but this enlightenment. You know, I get glimpses. And man, I'm free when the grasping stops.
But don't you find, haven't you found that, you know, blowing yourself through those walls, like, you know, even, you know, being able to become egoless or to rid yourself in whatever meditative state of all these manifestations of persona and false self, that, you know, you do land on something that is authentically you. I mean, you don't come to the bottom of that and there's
but it's
not,
a bigger you.
Right.
It's not a relative you.
Okay.
It's not a you that relates to other yous.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
The freedom comes in there only being one you.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And it includes the table and the computer and the ocean and the trees, and you try to breathe without them, you know, you can't.
That makes me a little tired to be that expansive. I found that very exhausting to be carrying.
Yeah, bringing it in every once in a while. Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's for me, it's just a moment of freedom whenever I remember it.
Good.
It's like, just to remember that you're the space in which all of this is happening is just,
Yeah, right, right. And ultimately right. You're just part of the frequency, and
you can hang on to that for a minute.
Yeah.
And then the illusion gets so compelling again, and your individuality gets
Or else
so
you just
compelling.
Have to, you know, make coffee. Yeah. I mean, it can be that simple, the illusion.
Yeah.
Like, I got to eat something.
Right. It's time to eat. Time to feed the body and brain. Right. Exactly. But I feel like a fragment of myself, this body and brain, I honestly think is a fragment of myself. So I'm being affected by all this stuff socially with all the needs of people and the protests and all that stuff at the same time. It's weird how this book has been kind of prophetic in ways, you know, it's turned out to kind of express some of the things that are going on, including the toppling of statues, you know.
Yeah.
Only we did it in a silly way. We went to Disney because it was the only place that we could topple a giant dwarf. And that just appeals to me in so many ways.
Yeah. No, I think the whole book reads very, like, from what the part I'm in it, and I do intend on finishing it. It's been very funny, and it's I like a good fucking satire of the business we're in and the culture we're in. Like, I've read other ones. I always enjoy them. I liked, I like Bruce Wagner stuff, Mark Lehner stuff. Like, but this stuff is like, you know, the fact that there is a true story within it, or as true as a story of your life could be in these different manifestations of Jim Carrey, is within it, I think, is an interesting added.
I definitely have the inside look. For
yes.
Sure.
Well, I mean, what was the writing process with you and Dana? I mean, did you pitch him chunks and then he wrote things?
Yeah, we did that. Uh-huh. We also, toward the last few years, we got in a room and just jammed 12 hours a day.
Uh-huh.
And you know, he's a magnificent prose writer.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about that. And we filled in each other's gaps, and it was wonderful. So I love telling stories and making up things that don't exist. And
yeah.
And I have a lot of experience to share and a well that's pretty deep.
You never lived in Hamilton, did you?
I lived in Burlington across the bay.
Yeah.
Before I came into comedy, I had put my applications in at Stelco and DeFasco.
It's not running anymore, that mill, is it?
I don't think so. One of them went out of business, I believe. It's the old thing, man. It's the old thing. Yeah, if the industry moves, you know, you're Detroit, you know, and
yeah.
You got a deal.
Yeah, it was pretty.
Flint,
it was
Michigan.
It was pretty heavy. So yeah. So Burlington's across the water from there.
Burlington's right across the water, across the Bay Bridge.
And that's where you grew up.
That's right. That's where kind of my most mischievous years happened. It was like from 11 to maybe 14.
Oh, really?
And then my father lost his job for the second time. And he was too old to get another job that was in a corporate structure. We moved to Scarborough and we got a job as a family being security guards and janitors. So I got thrown into the middle of this factory, this steel truck rim making factory, huge factory floor that I had to clean with sweepers and stuff like that, and the bathrooms. So I was in the middle of, you know, a very interesting situation. There were like two factions of people that kind of didn't get along, and I was in
right.
the center of that. And they used to defecate in the sinks and stuff like that.
Which factions of people?
Well, I don't want to say, but there was just like different religions clashing within the factory.
No kidding.
And daggers and all kinds of things going on.
Wow.
And I cleaned the place. And so you really haven't developed your character until you've had to clean urinals from factory worker bag scratch.
Yeah.
You know, when they go in after a real hard shift and they stand there urinating and like scratching their bags and in euphoria, you know, and I'm the one that had to, you know, take the skin samples collect them. Uh-huh. Yes. And the pubic hair.
Yeah.
That was my job. Master of pubic hair.
But so you like, and but where'd you start your early life?
I was born in Newmarket, Ontario, which is about, 25 miles north of Toronto.
And you were like, how many kids? How many were you?
I had two sisters and a brother.
Older?
All older.
So and, you're the last one.
I was the baby and I was the gifted child, I guess you'd call it. And it really was an imitation of my father, who was this insanely, joyful, incredibly funny, animated character that just didn't tell a story. He became the characters and he was, like this. Everything I've done in my comedy career can be traced back to that origin.
You love that guy.
And love that guy. Love that guy so much. And I used to watch him as a little kid and we used to watch Ed Sullivan together and Rodney Dangerfield on Ed Sullivan. And I had no idea what the jokes meant. I was just laughing because my father was laughing. You know, people were laughing in the studio and it was just magnificent. And I ended up being with Rodney later on. So
how great is Rodney?
So wonderful, man. So wonderful. And I got a beautiful email from Joan Dangerfield about the book because Rodney comes into the book. And he's treated in a kind of a really avant-garde way.
And we can get back to Rodney, but so you're growing up, your dad's a guy that, you know, gave you your faces and his charisma and his ability.
And my mom was the artist, so I got the artist from her.
She was a painter?
I got the best of, she was an artist. She used to get up in the middle of the night and make these beautiful murals and stuff for our rooms. And
really?
The only peaceful time she had. So yeah, she used to do that. So it's weird. The first 40 years of my life, I was mining the gold from the talent my father gave me. And then suddenly, like that, like overnight, I became an artist.
Isn't that interesting?
It's like I was spending time with my mother suddenly.
Isn't that wild how that stuff is carved into the neural pathway so young?
It's incredible. Yeah.
So when, what, now you say your dad lost his job twice, so you had rough times a couple of times.
Yeah. Yeah, we had rough times. And I went from being an A student to not being able to hear the teacher, Charlie Brown's teacher.
Oh, really?
Like that. And I was so angry. I blamed the world for messing with my father. So I was really kind of in a, really angry state of mind. I just wanted to fight.
Did it break him?
It did. It broke his heart. Yeah, it definitely broke his heart. But then, you know, as I say in the book, at a certain point, you know, I made him laugh so hard one time that his dentures fell out of his mouth.
Nice.
And from then on, he started dreaming through me and for me, you know. So he gave up his dream. You know, he was such a funny guy. Everybody said you could have been. And even Rodney said, Rodney was in love with Percy Carey. And he just like, he would marvel at him and go, who the fuck is this guy? You know? Where did he come? Where the hell are you doing? Why aren't you in the Catskills, man? You know, kind of thing. And he was just joke funny, man. Joke funny.
That's so funny because I started. That's my dad was is a bipolar guy, and my mom used to say to me when I was in high school, she used to say, "Why don't you go upstairs and make your father laugh? You're the only one who can." And I get
that
up
was
there
me with my mother,
right? And I get up there, and my dad be like, "I don't want to live anymore." I'm like, "Ooh, tough crowd, tough crowd."
Run around the room and make it sound like a genocide. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, there's always a sick parent, you know.
Your mom was
ask a lot of. My mother was not well, you know. She was on a lot of prescription medications, and in those days, it was just like have some more candy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what it was really funny. One time, my mother was smoking. She smoked like a fiend, and she had switched to menthol Benson and Hedges.
Right,
and I said, that smells weird, Mama. What are you smoking? And she was like, they're menthol. The doctor said they're better for me when I have a cold.
What? He probably
doctor,
did say that.
At that time, said that she should smoke menthol.
That is so
colds.
Fucking nuts. is so nuts.
It's the Dark Ages. We haven't, we're not long from the Dark Ages.
Well, we're not. I think we're re-entering the actual Middle Ages.
They're trying to drag us back in there.
Oh, my God. You know, these, like that sort of, let's not digress into that. But, okay, so after the second kind of, when did you start doing the comedy, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, again, that was my father's urging. I was ripping the house up every time company came over, and I was known in school and everywhere else as the cut up and the guy who was just always doing outrageous stuff. I used to do impressions of like Paul Lynn choking on a piece of meat and stuff like that. They were all really out there things.
Yeah.
But
can you do that
at a certain Paul Lynn, you're disgusting. Fuck. The center square to block. Oh, you people are. I don't know. I haven't done it for a while.
That's
gotta
good,
get
man.
That one back up and running.
That was good.
So I used to do that. And at a certain point, my father, and I think we were just at the end of our ropes because we walked away from that factory job.
Yeah.
Because it was affecting us in terrible negative
Sounds
ways.
Like it.
I mean, there was a lot of bigoted talk at the table, stuff like that. It was like we were just turning into people that we were not.
Monsters.
And monsters, hateful monsters.
Yeah.
And I was just trying to imagine how to fix people's brakes and stuff at night when I went to sleep. And I had a baseball bat on my cleaning cart that was ready to go. I was ready to go.
Rough.
And at a certain point, we looked at each other and we just said, we got to go.
Yeah.
And we had nothing to go to. Mm. We literally went camping for about 6 months into the winter.
Oh.
And
was that nice, though?
It was better than the terrible job that was turning us into monsters.
Okay.
It literally was a step up to have nothing.
What'd you learn in the forest?
The guy that would become my brother-in-law taught me about sex.
Oh, that's
and,
good.
You know, at night he would talk to me about what to do to a lady.
Yeah.
And all of that. So the first time I ever had it, I tried everything he talked about.
Yeah. How'd that go?
Yeah. It was good.
Oh,
it was good.
It
was a surprise, it was a party and I met somebody and she lived upstairs and I went up there and I remember trying everything in the world and I'm not sure if she noticed that I was a neophyte, but, I remember it very well. And the Styx Grand Illusion album was playing.
Oh, lady,
so, it's a grand illusion. Deep inside, we're all the same.
Dun, 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 dun.
I'm sailing away. Set an open course of emergency.
They were huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Come to that. It's fantastic.
Oh, great. Great. So you did good.
Oh, I exploded. I'm sorry. Yes, I did all right. I think I did all right. But there was also just this thing. We got to a point where my father said, I just heard about these places called comedy clubs.
Yeah.
And would you like to go down to Yuck Yucks in Toronto? And my mother suggested I wear my best polyester suit.
Nice.
And
what color?
My dad and I, it was a white polyester suit. I was way ahead of the Steve Martin curve.
Nice.
And I went down with my dad, and the big routine I did at that point was imitating the Carol Burnett show.
Mm.
I was doing all Tim Conway's characters.
How funny was that guy? Jesus!
No, he was so fast on his feet, man. Right, the last time I met him, he was getting up there, and man, the guy was quick, still really quick.
Very funny. So you're doing the Burnett riff?
Yeah, and at Yuck Yucks, they had this thing where if somebody wasn't going over well or wasn't, at that certain level of hipness.
Yeah.
They would start playing the theme to Jesus Christ Superstar.
To get you
crucify
off stage.
Him, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And Mark Breslin would get on the mic backstage and say, totally boring.
Oh my
totally
God.
Boring. Totally boring.
That guy and having
I was
that kind
15
of...
years old.
Oh my God.
And I didn't go back for 2 years. I left there that night. And I didn't go back for 2 years. And then I went back and killed it. You know, it was good for me. And it's good. Those tanks you do are really good for you.
I guess, you know? But what'd you do for the 2 years?
Prepared.
Oh, so you were doing open mics elsewhere?
No, I was just coming up with stuff.
No shit.
I was coming up with stuff. And I watched the other comics, and I watched the audience and what they're looking for. And, you know, at first, I guess you just try to fit in, try to fill that.
Let me ask you something, though, around this stuff, around, like, you know, the new realizations versus the life that you lived before the realizations. Is that, you know, how do you frame, you know, what you may have once viewed as mental illness? You know, I'm assuming that currently you have a different take on it than you might have had a decade ago. And I guess the deeper question is, when you started doing comedy, like for those 2 years, was your heart heavy?
No. It was always, for me, I created out of a place of joy and out of a place of wanting to free people from concern, like my mother.
Oh,
it
really
was born out of that. So, you know, I'd
to make her feel better.
When she was in pain, I'd get up on her bed in my underwear and be the praying mantis and drive her crazy until she was laughing hysterically and holding her belly and going, "It hurts."
Right. Yeah.
And so at a certain point I realized, oh, I could actually do this for the world. I could actually do this for large groups of people.
What point was that?
Freedom from concern.
Oh, right. Okay. So that's really where it came from.
It's a ministry. Yeah.
Huh. It was never self-medicating.
I think it became partly that. Mm. Art always becomes a way to express those deeper feelings.
Sure.
But I honestly think it's born, and it still is born out of trying to free people from concern, even if it's taking them, you know, head on into the concern so that it dissipates the intensity of it.
Yeah. So when you went back to Yuck Yucks and you killed, that was the beginning of the career then?
Yeah. And then I became a featured player at Yuck Yucks, featured player in the theater of the absurd.
And when did you like come to LA?
Came to LA. I met a guy named David Holliff, who was managing Howie Mandel. And
Canadian guy.
Yeah, Canadian guy.
Yeah.
And he was one of those few guys back then that could see the next level, that could see to the next stage.
Yes.
And there were a lot of people that didn't really see where things could go. And, you know, now you can stay in Toronto and do just fine, you know.
I mean, I get that. But I mean, you know, you're going to, like, some people can do all right. And that just means, you know, you get to do all the Yuck Yucks twice a year.
Yeah, but I mean, there's SCTV, you know, there's the Kids in the Hall. There's some great stuff.
Oh, no, of course. But I mean, as a stand-up, though, like at the beginning, were you really thinking that like stand-up was the thing?
I didn't know. I had a dream about being an artist that could do a lot of things, you know, and not having boundaries, you know, and I've always kind of believed that there's no limit to the areas I could kind of sneak into.
Well, I mean, it's clear, like, the way that you sort of did what you do early on, you know, was sort of like, you definitely somehow pushed the envelope, even, you know, with familiar things, you know, even with impressions, your approach to them was sort of, you know, kind of got pretty out there.
Yeah, I was the man of 1,000 faces.
Sure.
I was the rubber face, yeah. Right.
But you're always able to, even when you did characters, you know, create a different time zone for everybody.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's the key. It's the basis to one of my most serious beliefs and my strongest beliefs. And that involvement and immersion in someone else.
Yes.
And in fact, in your own work is heaven.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was in my studio painting in New York one time, and I took a walk for a couple of blocks, and I found this wonderful little park where these guys were playing soccer. And I felt so free from the painting because it involves your heart, your head, and your hands. It takes everything, right?
Right.
And I always wondered why I was so free and felt so good and euphoric doing it. And then I watched these guys play soccer. I watched this guy chasing the ball. And I went, that's it. I was compelled by that guy who was so involved with getting the ball. And that's why all sports work, you know, all art works on the same level, and that is presence. You know, presence is addictive, man. And when someone is fully present, like Michael Jordan is in the zone,
yeah,
it's like, it's addictive, man. You cannot, you know, Meisner, one of the tenets of his technique is that if you are actually interested in what you're doing, you'll be interesting to watch, you know? And that's why we watch babies, because they discover things for the first time.
Sure.
You know? And that's why we watch art. That's why we watch everything. When you look at Da Vinci, you're seeing his presence on the canvas.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And it's addictive. You can't not be compelled by it.
Yeah. And I think that's also something about, that's part of the addiction to live performance as well.
Yes. In the moment.
Yes.
When you have the sense that somebody, I mean, we all have plans, you know, but when you have the sense that somebody is like kind of discovering their own material as they speak.
That's the best. You know? I was just watching, I've been home, you know, and I can't go out and do the work, you know, so I've been watching, you know, guys. I watched this documentary, oddly, on Rodney the other night, which was great. But I turned on that first Pryor special last night. I haven't watched it in a year or two, live in concert.
And it's so beautiful.
Oh, it's, did you ever notice that he comes out on
stage? Fantastic time capsule.
Yeah, but he comes out on stage and they're not even back from intermission yet. Like, he walks out on stage in Long Beach and there's like 100 people looking for their seats. They don't even know he came out. And I'm like, what the
fuck? He doesn't care. He's not about that. He wasn't about showbiz. He wasn't about the glitz. He was about, let's connect.
Yeah.
I'm going to connect.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to connect with myself.
Right. Right.
I'm going to play these characters like they're happening in front of you right now. And the best actors do that. You know, they have to rediscover the part every time they do it. If you do 10 takes, you have to rediscover it every time.
That's the job.
In the moment.
In a way.
Yes, the job.
So, all right. So when do you come? So the guy who manages Howie says, I'm going to make you a star, kid, or what?
He says, we should go to L.A. and do that. And I had been to L.A. once with Demi Thompson and Ron Scribner were a couple of guys that were managing me very early on. And then I came back. I had a bad experience in LA.
Boy.
I was supposed to do the Tonight Show, and they set up this huge showcase at the Improv one night. And it was two days before I was supposed to do the Tonight Show. And Jim McCauley was there. And
yeah.
Everybody was very excited about this new kid from Canada that had been talked about. And I had a lukewarm night.
You know?
It was just, there were too many industry people for it to be a good night.
That room, you know, I don't think that room was good.
I had some good times in that room. But
it's just one of those nights. I get it. Yeah, a little flat.
It was one of those nights where it was just a little flat.
Yeah.
And I walked away and I felt it all going away.
Oh.
And everybody patted me on the back and said, you did good.
Yeah.
You know,
I
remember Ruth Buzzy coming out and saying like, that was great.
That
I was like, oh God, it was the kindness. Yeah. The kindness was killing me.
Yeah, the compliments, they erase themselves as they're coming out of their mouths. That was good.
Wow, you really have something there. You got the makings.
Yeah, that's the worst.
You got
worst,
the makings.
The worst.
You got
tone.
The recipe. Just don't cook it so long.
Right. As if they're answering you just saying like, did I suck?
Absolutely. Yeah. And sure enough, like a day later, I got the call that Jim McCauley didn't think I was ready for the
God
Tonight Show
damn.
And that I lost the Tonight Show. And, you know, I mean, that has created, you know, that's caused suicide before. I mean, you know,
Lubitkin?
People have killed themselves.
Lubitkin didn't do it over that, though.
No, you couldn't get spots. But it wasn't that he lost the Tonight Show. It was that without the Comedy Store, you couldn't get the Tonight Show. You couldn't go to the next level.
When did you get to the store?
I got there to stay. I went there in 1979 and I auditioned for Mitzi and I stayed at the Saharan Motel, which is a character in the book.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And I remember walking in and having a hooker come up to me and say, do you want a date? And I thought, wow, it's Sadie Hawkins Day. I didn't know what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and I walked in there. It looked like something from a cop show to me. And like I had
Walking up the stairs to the booth?
Yeah, I was in the Rockford Files. I was in Beretta, or whatever.
Yeah.
It was a new world for me. And I was reading The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey that it was purporting to have absolute knowledge and surety that the world was going to end very soon.
Uh-huh.
And there were biblical references and everything in there. So I wanted to check them. I went and asked the manager, who was wearing a Stetson and smoking a stogie by the pool, if he had any extra Bibles, because I wanted to check the Bible references
at the hotel.
My book. Yeah. And he started howling with laughter and he threw his hat down and he said, "Boy, there ain't a Bible in all of Hollywood." And I knew where I was. And, but I auditioned for Mitzi, went on that trip, and I never got to see her. She was sitting at the back of the room, and I again had a kind of a weird night where the mic fell apart and in my hands.
Why can't they fucking get like a good goddamn, we need one thing to do our job. One thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it was just one of those nights where I wasn't in the right spot. So I didn't wait. I blew past her so fast and went back to Canada for 2 years. That's what I do. I screw up the first time, then I regroup. I came back in 81 to stay in Los Angeles. Yeah.
And she let you in?
And she, yeah, right away it was on, and I was a regular, and it was a fantastic moment, man. What a door to open. And Bud was always cool with me too. You know, spots at the Improv. For some reason, I never experienced that. You're not supposed to play one club or the other. It never happened for me that way.
Well, yeah, by the 80s, though, that, you know, that shit was, you know, if you were big enough, they weren't
burning each other's clubs down.
No,
anymore.
No, those days were over. But who were your contemporaries at the store in that year?
Robin, you know, it was me, it was Kinison, it was Robin, it was, you know, Eddie Murphy was coming in to try stuff out. Richard Pryor was there all the time.
Right.
Richard Pryor was going through a really weird period where I think he had done, you know, he had done the first thing and he had burnt up.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
He was questioning his abilities because he was doing it straight. And he went in and out. I found myself in the parking lot one night, 21 years old, and standing, everybody else left, and suddenly I found myself standing with Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
Which is enough to, you know, for any comic to just wet his pants.
Yeah.
You know, and we passed a joint back and forth.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Be careful with this stuff." And he said, "I don't remember 40 years of my life."
Huh.
And I said, "What?" And I was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
I said, "What?" And he said, "I'm not sure it was me."
Huh.
And it was like a harpoon going through me, like the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
I was having those kind of doubts.
Yeah.
You know, of course it was him.
Right.
Of course it was everything he'd ever lived.
Right.
But at that moment, he was having real, real serious doubts about whether it was him who was inspired to do it or it was the drugs.
But you've had that feeling?
Yeah, sure. I called my father a night after I smoked a joint and I went on stage and I eviscerated the room.
Yeah.
And Kinison even was at the back of the room and he started messing with me just to see what I was made of.
Right.
And I just annihilated him that night.
Oh, good.
And it was amazing. And I was Lenny, man. It was just coming. It was just like, yeah, man. Yeah. I needed the rim shots.
Yeah.
I needed the pap and pap, you know? And I was a comedy priest, man.
Oh, it's good, man. It's good when you can nail the bully in the back of the room.
Oh, my God. But he was just testing me. And I did fantastic. And I came off stage and he came up and everybody came up and they said, "Holy crap, man, you were just off the hook. You were transcendent, man." And I went, "I was high."
Ah.
You know, and I went home immediately and I called my father, who was a jazz musician.
Uh-huh.
And I said, because I started thinking, well, maybe should I do it this way?
Right.
And I called him up and I said, you know, you must have run in, you know, being in the jazz game, you must have run into a lot of musicians that were using and heroin stuff and things like that. And he said, yeah, I knew a lot of guys.
Yeah.
I knew a lot of guys that were getting there that way. And I never did. Because I figured if I made it that way, I could never own it.
Right, right, right.
And that's exactly, in fact, what Richard was going through.
Right, right.
Whether he could, wondering whether he could own this greatness that everybody.
Interesting. Yeah.
Gives to him.
So you chose against it.
I chose against it. I can't do it. If I can't take credit for it, what the hell is it worth, man? You know what I mean?
That's interesting that people would look at it like that. I mean, there were so many dudes, like I certainly did my share of drugs.
Yeah, me too, man. I mean, I'm no choir boy,
right,
you know,
right.
but I never created and, you know, relied on it to create.
Well, yeah, there were cats that couldn't get on stage without it.
No, yeah.
Like, you know, I knew a lot of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Steve Kravitz used to walk around the halls at the Comedy Store going, was I on yet?
Oh, that's great.
So what's the Kennison story?
Oh, well, you know, when we met, he was working the door and he had started doing late night spots,
right,
about, you know, the last one,
yeah,
like, you know, 1:45 in the morning.
Right.
And that's all he could get at that time. And he came up to me, and at that point I was already a regular and I was playing in the main room and I was getting standing ovations every night.
Yeah.
And he came up to me and he said, man, I'm just such a fan. I love what you do. And I go on really late at night. I go on the last spot in the original room, and would you hang out and watch me? And I said, yeah, sure. So I hung out that night and I watched him.
Yeah.
Makes me cry to think about it. I sat at the back of the room, man, and I watched the world change.
Yeah.
You know? And I was crying with laughter.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I had ever seen somebody marry, you know, comics are usually intellectualizing things.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
they go above the emotion to intellectualize something and say to the world, you know, here's how you deal with it without having to come apart.
Uh-huh.
But he was the first one that was immersed in his emotions.
Yeah.
And his anger.
Yeah.
And expressing that at the same time as there were these brilliant routines that I'd never heard anything like.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was watching Bird. I was watching Charlie Parker.
Oh,
I was
wow.
watching, you know, early Miles Davis. I was like, I was seeing something really extraordinary. And he came off stage and came up to me and said, what do you think? And I said, what I think? I think you're it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And good luck to you. Because that's going to be difficult.
Yeah.
Plus he picked, I knew that he had picked a character and a persona, as we speak about the book.
Yeah.
And the personas we create that sometimes we can't live up to.
The Beast.
He created a persona that he couldn't get out of, basically.
Or live up to.
Every time he got sober, people came up and screamed in his face.
Yeah.
And needed him to be the Beast, you know? And
yep.
So that was a very hard thing to get out of. We drove to Tulsa together, and he was going to train me how to preach, and we were going to go on the road. Because he wasn't known yet. We were going to go on the road as Pentecostal preachers.
Uh-huh.
And he was going to call me Lightning Boy Jim.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to do the thing. We never got to do it, but I got to listen to him preach in the garage with Brother Marnie and the family.
Some energy, right? It was the energy.
Incredible, incredible energy. And it was kind of wild to see, because he hit so hard, you know, at a certain point that he got kind of carried away and frozen in the image of himself. And so you notice, like, the second album and the second third Letterman isn't as tight and isn't as, it's more about who he's become.
Well, it's about
what he had to say.
It became, it became sort of like, I can do this fucked up.
But it also became like a rock star. He became a rock star.
Yeah, that was crazy.
And every rock star in the world was fawning all over him. So it was tough. It's a tough ego thing, man, when you're faced with that kind of, you know, reverence, you know, coming at you. You know, I don't think he was able to handle it.
Yeah, but the guitar thing, my feelings about him are complicated, you know, but it just seemed to me that, you know, the clarity of that first record, or the night you saw him, or the night that you were hanging out with
him. The vision,
him,
yeah.
Yeah.
There
and,
was a vision.
And like, you know, a lot of people don't realize, like, when you walked into the room and he was doing that shit from that first record, he changed this, the energy in the fucking room.
No, it was crazy.
It was menacing, dude. It was menacing.
Woe to those who became offended enough to leave, because then he was ripping you apart. It was the guy had his dick in her purse and I hope you find a lump. And I mean, my God, he would go to places that people were just, what did he say?
But, you also were able to create a sort of different energy because of the intensity you brought to it. And you became a star before him. So I'm imagining you're looking at him going through his paces. And I don't know how close you guys remained, during that time, or if you were at all, or he used to hide himself from you at that point. But I mean,
there was a time when we split, because he was going down that direction of the outlaw.
Yeah.
And I hung for a long time with him, and we got in some scraps and together, and there was some, it got pretty hairy around Sam,
dude.
It was pretty hairy. So I just know myself, and I know that I wasn't meant to be, I have a rebellious streak, but I'm not an outlaw,
And me too.
And I, there came a time where, we had a sit down that did not turn out well.
Right.
Because he wanted me to come on the road with him. And I said, I just can't, Sam. I'm sorry.
I'd like to live.
To do my own thing. Yeah. I'm clinging to this thing called life.
That was always the feeling I got. Someone's going to go down. It's probably going to be
me.
And
it will be me.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm the guy that catches up what meant for him.
Exactly.
That's right.
But, it seems like Rodney was equally as important in his life as he was in yours.
Rodney was important to so many young comics, man. He just opened a door for a ton of people. All these people that had personal experiences with Rodney. I mean, the first time he ever hired me, he looked at me and he started laughing. And he said, "Kid, have you ever been in love like that?" And he just was tickled by the fact that I just had not had any human experience whatsoever.
Right.
It was just pure love coming at it.
Yeah.
And we had just this wonderful, magical relationship. And I still quote him to young comics and people that I know. There's a bit of it in the book, where he would say to me, "Kid, you got to make the tank so strong no boneheaded motherfucker can fucking stop it. No bonehead can get in your way because the tank's too strong."
Yeah, he was a real warrior comic, that guy.
He was, man, and a surgeon.
Yeah.
If you look at those old shows of Rodney Dangerfield with Johnny Carson.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Johnny was like, "Oh, yeah? And then what happened?"
Yeah.
"Oh, that must have been fun." How many about like that? He's just literally just marking the space between the jokes with sounds.
It was the best thing that happened is when one of them doesn't work as well as he wanted.
"You should just stay out of my way, man." Yeah. You know what I mean?
But when a joke flops, I love when he's sort of like, "Oh, should have tried that one again at the club," or whatever. He's got those moments where
I gotta work on that one. I gotta work at that one. You know what I mean? I gotta tell you. And we had such a beautiful relationship, and he was always my friend, and he loved my father, and he stuck with me when I was experimenting and the audience had no clue what I was doing, whereas other people jumped ship.
Which bits?
I was in Vegas, doing, I called it performance art because it just wasn't funny
Right.
At that point. I was just exploring. I would spend like 15 minutes being a cockroach escaping from a vacuum cleaner, and that would be the substance of it. Or I'd be the guy, this snake, the guy that wanted to deal right there on stage, or whatever. I was an alien from another planet.
And Rodney, what did he say?
He said, "You're trying some stuff, huh, kid?" Like that. And I go, "Yeah." And he go, "That's good. That's good. Keep it fresh. Keep it fresh." He was just a big supporter and a big fan. And then when he passed, Joan gave me this lovely box, with a leather bound box with Rodney's favorite shirt and his pot pipe. So if you know Rodney, that's pretty much the grail.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
The pot pipe.
Yeah.
Keeps me creative, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
it was that beautiful link to the past that was so important. Yeah. You know? And then I got to meet Pryor and all these guys and Robin Williams, who was just, you know, the fastest gun in the West. Just absolutely incredible. You know, so I can't even tell you how lucky I feel. I don't know how you feel about your era. Did you feel that for your era at the Comedy Store?
Yeah, I mean, I got to, when I was there, it was mostly Sam, you know, and I got kind of caught up with that. And Dice was also breaking. But I saw Richard come in a couple of times and he was beaten up again. You know, he was trying to get back on the horse again. He wasn't sick
yet.
Yeah,
he would literally be at the microphone saying, "I'm not funny."
Yeah, yeah.
And the audience would go, "No, you are, you rough. Are." And he'd go, "No, I'm really not. I don't feel funny right now."
And in terms of like guys my generation who were there, like when I was at the store, it was a little dark period and people didn't really love to come around there. Like even industry people were a little wary of the place. And, you know, but all those cats that you were there with were still around, you know, like Joey came
in. It's like Saturday Night Live, isn't it? It's like it goes through those phases where it's the...
Yeah.
There's a kind of a down period where nothing.
Well, the Sam period was very dark because he would bring in, when he was running the place, Sam, it was all the porn stars and the weirdos and the drug fiends and the Satanists. It was a crazy dark time. And then you got people like Joey Kamen and Jan Haber doing sets and Karen Haber.
Sticking tennis balls in his mouth.
Exactly. You know, in the midst of this chaos, and I was living up at Crest Hill and Sam would party up there.
Jugglers.
Yeah. And Becker would call us the Manson family.
Yeah,
because we were up there just like
It was pretty decadent.
It was an important period in my life, but I had to run away being chased by things only I saw. I got myself into a psychotic drug-induced state. Then I had
Did
to
really
yeah and I got into a fight with Sam and I lost my mind on cocaine and I had to go regroup, and it took a couple of years
after you called your second grade teacher and said, "Why did we never get together?
What's happening? Are you available? How old are you?
What are
now?
You doing tonight?"
I went back to New Mexico and I kind of pulled my brain back together and restarted my career in Boston. Because it was
good
always
for you, man. I'm so happy for you, man. I honestly think you're great.
Oh,
and
thanks,
and I really love it because you're an honest guy and you share that in a really cool way.
It's always been about the stand up, you know, at the beginning. You know?
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful to watch. I enjoy stand up so much watching it. You know, I don't know if I'll ever go back to do it. It could happen, but I love it.
Was there a point where you were like, I've got to go a different route here? Like, you know, there's a mention in the book where you were like, it seemed like, you know, when you were in Vegas, you kind of saw that life and it didn't seem like that was the life you wanted.
I could not die there. No, I don't.
But you knew it was a possibility.
I do not trust white tigers.
Yeah.
and I cannot, you know, no, the whole atmosphere. I can go to Vegas for a night. But, you know, the controlled atmospheres and the rooms and stuff like that, and the trying to whatever, there's nothing on the television, so that it just compels you to go down and spend your money. Last time I was playing at the Comedy Store at the Dunes, I was with Dice, actually.
Yeah.
And he was in the room going, "Don't let me blow this last $100, man."
Yeah.
Like that. I'm going, "What do you mean?" And he goes like, "I'm serious. Are you like, I got $100 left. I've lost everything. Yeah. And you can't let me blow this last $100 like that." And I go, "Okay, I'll try to keep an eye on you," like that. And I went in the bathroom to go pee and I came out and he was gone.
Yeah.
And the $100 was gone.
Yeah.
That was the Dunes. And
she had the store there, right?
I had the store there and I was playing there. I was a featured player at the store. The techs were impossible.
Yeah.
"Can I have a stool?" Stool? Get stool yourself, man. 2-bit comic, whatever. And they were just brutal. And I remember being in my room one night and I was going through a phase where I was listening to positive affirmation tapes. And
were you depressed?
No, I was just trying to motivate myself and move the universe, the secret before the secret ever existed, right?
Right.
I was always doing that. So I put those headphones on and I laid back on my bed and my tidy whities and I fell asleep while I was listening to "You Are a Winner and Everything Comes Easily to You." Cue the seagulls.
Yeah.
You know, and I was listening to that and I fell asleep and I was blissed out sleeping, and suddenly I sensed something or heard something, and I kind of like slowly blinked my eyes open. I saw light coming in from the hallway and I went, "Oh, I must have left a light on." And then I looked to the other side of my bed, right beside me, at the nightstand, I saw something moving. And initially I thought, is that a cat on the table? And then the depth perception kicked in.
Yeah.
And I realized I was staring at a human face about 2 feet away from mine. It was a woman with long hair going through my wallet on the nightstand.
What?
Going through my wallet. And I leapt out of bed and grabbed her. And she got up and she was about 6'4".
What?
And she kept saying, she was acting like she was a prostitute, saying, I thought you were Frank. They sent me up for Frank. Like that.
Yeah.
And I grabbed her and I threw her out into the hallway. The door was fully open.
Yeah.
And apparently I hadn't put the bolt on.
Right.
And she came with the do not disturb sign and just flicked it open.
Get out of here.
And then she ran to the elevator where there was a guy holding the elevator for her.
Uh-huh.
And I was so freaked out and I called down to security and I went down to the security office, which was like, the police station in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
I mean, it was huge. This police station inside the casino where I looked at mugshots and I found her and they said, oh yeah, her. Yeah. She works all the hotels. Did you have your deadbolt on? Were you listening to motivational tapes?
Uh-huh. She saw you coming. Yeah.
Yeah, she saw you coming, buddy. So that was just bizarre.
That was Vegas.
You are a winner.
Yeah, nope.
So that was Vegas. And when I saw the dunes go down, when I saw the demolition of the dunes, which is in Casino, by the way,
yeah,
it marked a moment in my life that I was very happy about. I was glad to see that go.
I bet. So how does the transition? I mean, obviously we don't have time to go through everything, but I mean, was there like any, when I know you did a few movies and you're obviously a known quantity, but when Living Color happens, was there any part of you that was sort of like, well, I'm a stand-up. I don't know if I'm going to.
No, I was always up for new directions and new experiences.
But Damon, you knew Damon and Keenan from.
Damon was at the Comedy Store with me, and we did Earth Girls Are Easy together.
How great was he to watch?
He was fantastic.
Right?
So funny, so edgy, man, so incredibly dark.
And he can riff, dude.
Unbelievable. And just courageous beyond belief.
Yeah, for
courageous
sure.
Beyond belief. He had the sickest routine, some of them. I remember one in particular. Where I don't know if your listeners aren't going to see this, but his sister got beat up by her boyfriend,
uh-huh.
and he went to visit her in the hospital.
Yeah.
And she was really messed up, and he said, "Why are you going out with that dude? What is it? Why are you doing that to yourself?"
Yeah,
and she says, "I don't know. There's just something about him."
That sounds like him.
I fell out, man. I fell out.
Yeah.
And he's the one that invited me to audition for In Living Color. And God, it changed my life.
Did you guys have any idea, you know, what that was going to be like? I mean, in conception, or was it just a sketch show? I mean, what was the pitch? Because it was Keenan. Because Keenan was doing stand-up too a bit, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Nobody had done the sketch stuff,
yeah.
Really. I mean, you know, when I got on the show, Damon said to me, you're going to have to come up with some characters. I'd never done characters before.
Right. Oh, really?
So I just kind of opened up my perception and started looking for people and characters.
Yeah.
And the first one was Vera DeMilo. She presented herself to me at Gold's Gym in Santa Monica.
No kidding.
I was getting a smoothie and she came up to the counter and said, can I have a protein smoothie, please? You know, and it was this wonderfully homunculus woman. And and I went, well, there's one.
Yeah. You
know? And then started evolving into characters. Fire Marshal Bill was born out of a sketch that Adam Smalls and Fax Barr and I created called the Death Wish Foundation. It was a sketch about, you know, kids who are passing away and their posthumous wish is what we were concentrating on.
Right.
So they would make posthumous wishes. And my posthumous wish as this sick kid was to go to an amusement park after I die.
Right.
And so it would be me on the rides, you know, flopping around in the seats on the roller coaster and stuff like Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah.
And And that didn't get on, but the character stuck, and the character became Fire Marshal Bill.
Oh my God, that's a nice dark backstory.
Crazy, right? That grouping of people, and I wrote a lot with Steve Odekirk, who is also responsible for a lot of my early success and just did incredible, incredible work. And when people went to see Ace Ventura, they were going because of Fire Marshal Bill.
Right. Sure.
They were going to see what this lunatic is going to do next, basically. And they were happy with what they saw. So it was really wonderful. And but Steve Odekirk and I wrote that late night after we'd written sketches for In Living Color.
The first Ace Ventura?
The first Ace Ventura. We rewrote the original script.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know if I was actually going to do the movie or not. I had a trap door. I didn't have to do it if I didn't like it. But we got so pregnant with it that it was just, we were just out of our minds with laughter over this thing. And it was a freedom that everybody should operate under the idea that it's never going to get done. So just go crazy.
But then it was like crazy because then like you basically defined the movie comedy business, you know, for like years, dude. I mean, that 94
is freedom, man. It's freedom. It's the idea of freedom. If you get out of the way of the zeitgeist, man, if you get out of the way of the inspiration, you have the courage to do what's in your head and what you think is funny, you know, then you hit a nerve. Then you hit the back row.
After Ace Ventura, you could do whatever you wanted.
Yeah, I was very fortunate with The Mask and Dumb and Dumber right after that. But each time I was going, okay, don't get safe, don't get safe, don't get safe.
Yeah.
You know, so when Dumb and Dumber came along and I got my first big payday, I knocked my filling out of my tooth or my bonding out of my tooth out of rebellion against mammon, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't want to become a mammonite. I wanted to be an artist. Always.
So you were against the greed monster.
So I showed up with the bowl cut and my tooth, you know.
I was really knocked out.
Yeah, I have a bonding on my front tooth. Whenever I went back to do any Dumb and Dumb or anything, I have to. And the first time I just took a Bic lighter and I went, and I knocked it off.
Right.
You know, and I showed up like that. And Pete and Bobby were, oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Lloyd. Hello, Lloyd. You know, and it was a reaction to becoming popular. I wanted to fly in the face of it. And all the way along, like the stand up into the In Living Color sketch stuff, into the movies and now into the book and into the art, mm-hmm. and the comics, the political cartoons. I think I have this disease that will not allow me to become really entrenched in people's minds in one place.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think as time will tell, you're entrenched in people's minds in a lot of different ways. Everyone has got a different Jim Carrey in their mind, I would think most people.
Yeah, but that's because I take the chance and I challenge my audience a lot. You know, I ask a lot from them, a lot of understanding from them. I think I'm going to go off now and not do anything that you like, and I'm going to develop a new thing, and then I'm going to bring it back and, you know, glue it onto the thing you like.
Right. And also you take chances, and you talk about that in the book, that, you know, part of that, you know, those chances are, you know, the battle of seeing yourself as a failure.
Yeah. Yeah.
This idea that, you know, that, you know, when you do take a chance and it doesn't pay off, even though you're artistically were knew you were taking that chance, there still is, you know, the public's opinion of it or the critical opinion of it versus, you know, what you feel. And that's a hard place to be sometimes.
Yeah. But you can't step in the direction of appeasing. You can't pander.
Right.
You know,
sure.
You can't pander and create at the same time. It's just not conducive. You know, it really isn't. You can hope that they will like it, that it will hit a nerve, but you can't pander because they, even if they don't know it on the surface, they know it inside. They instinctually know.
What do you think was the biggest risk you ever took, really, in films?
I mean, there's so many things, but you know, Philip Morris, I got a lot of resistance about, especially
sex scene,
butt fucking scene.
Yeah.
My people went fucking mad, and so did the film company, and they were just out of their minds over that thing. And I said, you know what? You're the guys that would take the horse's head out of the Godfather. Stop trying to file down the fucking edges. And I fought and I fought and I fought and I threatened not to promote. And I did everything that an artist can do to say, you fuck with this, I'm gone, you know? And that was an interesting day because that was that gentleman's first day as an actor.
Really?
Yes. It was a very precarious position to be in on your first day.
But with these more serious movies, the ones that, you know, you really kind of, you know, challenged, I guess you would consider challenging your fans' expectations by doing, you know, roles in, I don't know, Eternal Sunshine, I think, you know, was your greatest dramatic role, really, for me.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
And Truman Show, I think the magic of Truman Show was that the concept was so original and prophetic.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
As it turns out, everybody has their bubble they're living in now. You know, everybody's Truman now.
That's for sure.
You know, like I get asked a lot, what do you think happens to Truman when he leaves the stage and goes through the door? And I say he has to watch everybody go back into the stage and try to seek what he had.
Right.
You know, that fame and that focus. And so he's alone again.
Yeah, I always pictured, you know, like there were periods where I'd hear about you, like, you know, we don't really have too many common friends. I guess I just made assumptions that, you know, I'd see you publicly go through these different relationships and have these hard times. And then I read an article about, you know, you had this...
Scared Straight, the Jim Carrey story.
Yeah, the butler that I thought was fascinating. I just picture you and your butler there in the house. Just you sitting there.
You really just can't call it a butler now. It's like a house manager,
house
really.
Manager,
just
right. Does, yeah.
Keeps just, the house from falling apart, just, from becoming, Great Expectations.
But like you sitting at a Citizen Kane-sized table eating dinner by yourself. And...
Right. It was Bud. That's right.
But
putting a with some beautiful woman putting a puzzle together.
Angrily. Yeah. Wishing she would go out.
Feeling unrealized.
But did you take, did you study acting at some point?
Yeah, I did. I went down, you know, when I quit the store and doing stand-up.
You actively quit stand-up? You just said,
I quit stand-up. I can't do this. It's leading to Vegas, which is the Impressionist Act.
Right.
So I knew I couldn't pursue that any longer. So I just walked away for a while and I studied Meisner and Stanislavski, and I did acting classes and started auditioning for acting roles. And then 2 years later, I got the bug again and I went, okay, now I think I can come back to it with a different perspective and actually create my own persona, you know? And that's what I was after. And I struggled, man, for a long time. People yelling at me to do Golden Pond and do the crowd-pleasing act again.
Yeah.
And even Mitzi at one point in Vegas said to me, you're the king of impressions. What are you doing? Like that. And I said, you know, they freaked out when Bob Dylan went electric.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. What'd you say to that?
I need a grace period. She went, okay, whatever. Like that. And then she still supported me. She still supported me. And then I slowly started to develop. I did 6 months where I challenged myself by not allowing myself to repeat a word that I said the night before.
Okay.
So I would go up unarmed completely and bleed in front of the crowd. And, you know, whereas I saw Robin doing his thing and I knew he had bits and I knew he would branch off in the moment, I figured if I trained, it's like training with weights on, if I didn't have anything to go to and I just either sank or swam, I would come out the other side, a stronger artist, you know? So I did that for 6 months, man. And I bled before I went on stage every night. Like I was starting off in show business.
Oh my God.
Again. It was horrifying. And, Sam came up to me at a certain point and he said, man, I see what you're doing, man. You got giant balls. You got giant balls and everybody's watching, you know? And comics were back there. If you're not going to use that bit, man.
Yeah, right.
I heard
right.
what you're doing. If you're not using that shit, I'm doing it.
Right.
You know, whatever. And a couple of, you know, entertainer type comics, you know,
sure.
gobbled up my old impressionist act and went to Vegas with it.
Really?
Yeah, I used to have people coming up to me and saying, like, your act is killing in Vegas.
Did you let them have it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you come out the other side, you know.
I came out the other side one night in my bed. I used to literally go to bed at night going, what do they need? What do they need? What do they need? What is it? What's my thing, you know, going to be? And one night I just shot up in bed and said out loud, they need to be free from concern.
Uh-huh.
It's the old thing I've been doing my whole life. They need to be free from concern.
Yeah.
And it was like a revelation that I would become the guy, my persona would be the guy that was free from concern.
Right.
And in doing so, you know, they would, through osmosis, get that feeling for themselves.
Yeah.
Right? Right. And then the next night I went to the Comedy Store and I said, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And how are you this evening? All righty then. And they realized I don't give a damn how they are. And I'm not concerned. And I, you know, and I'm really not going to wait for an answer.
Uh-huh.
and that created my stage show and my persona. It also created Ace Ventura, the attitude of Ace Ventura.
Wild, man.
Yeah.
And the end of your stand-up.
But it comes always from the belief, and it, you know, the book touches on this a lot, that fear of erasure thing, man, that causes everything from, you know, egoic tyrants to racists.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
People afraid to be replaced, you know, and it's the weakest thing that you could put out into the universe. I've always believed that I don't know how I'm going to find a place for myself, but you know, the front door has been blocked, but I can go through the basement window. I know that there will be an opening. There will be something presenting itself. So I've had that undying belief my whole life.
Yeah, it's what drives you. So after this tremendous expansion, both ego-wise, fame-wise, money-wise, you know, women-wise and everything else, was there a point where you came up empty and that's where you crashed?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. There were many crashes. There's still crashes.
But what do you attribute that to? How do you feel about your mental health?
I attribute it to, I believe that no one gets through this life. It's too challenging and there's too much stuff coming at us. We don't have the bandwidth to handle it.
Yeah.
We have to find ways to escape it. We have to turn the gadgets off. We have to find moments of in nature. Meditation is helpful, really helpful. Breathing techniques, you know, there's a lot of that's, you know, I get up and I walk and I do cold plunges and I, you know, I do give my body every chance it can get.
No more medicine?
To be healthy. I have very little supplementation, you know, in my life. Yeah. You know, just a little handful of pills or supplements that I take you know, with dinner and that's about it. But no, I still get into spirals of thought and, you know, just eruptions of anger and disappointment in humanity, you know, in the human species, in the narrowness of someone's perceptions.
But no existential sadness?
I don't think so.
That's
no,
good.
No.
Oh, good for you.
No, really not. No, it's not. It's not a, just a general depression.
Good.
Anymore at all.
Great.
It's been at times, but no, I don't have that. I know when I'm not happy, I'm not in the place I should be.
Right. Yeah.
Or
yeah,
I'm indulging in what I call time travel.
Yeah.
You know, the ego doesn't ever allow you to stay in this moment. It tries to ruin this moment.
Yeah.
You know, you and I are the only thing in the world to me right now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And the trees outside that are kind of,
sure,
you know, tickling my senses.
Right.
You know, they're, as soon as you lose that, you're caught in ego. You're time traveling. You're going back to regret or you're going forward to fear.
Yeah. Or yeah, your brain's just making shit up for you to react to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And half the time it's stuff that has never happened. You're having a fight and then some kind of crazy oration with somebody that you've never even
met. Right. You're reacting to
things. You're assuming that they're going to hate you.
Yeah. They're not real. It's not real.
Not real. So much of what we go through is not real stuff. So much of who we are is not real stuff.
I get that.
Well, that's where the book takes you. And you get in touch with me and let me know if it takes you there. Because that's what my intention was, is to do through this absurdism, you know, and this autofiction, to get to a place where I can actually give people a glimpse or a feeling of freedom. from grasping.
Well, I'm excited about it. I'm sorry that I didn't finish it before I talked to you.
Oh, that's okay, man.
But
that's
I will.
I'm the slowest reader in the world.
Yeah, and because I'm enjoying it, and I didn't know if I would, but I like it, and I'm going to finish it, and I will, you know.
Griffin Dunn called me yesterday.
Oh, he did?
And said that he had read it in two sittings, and he's dyslexic.
Yeah. You guys are kind of, so, you guys have things in common, I feel.
I think so.
He's a heavy cat, you know?
He's a heavy cat, man. Yeah. And an incredible family. What a family.
Yeah, yeah.
Just genius family. So I'm reading Joan Didion right now.
I just finished Joan Didion's A Year of Magical Thinking.
A Year of Magical Thinking.
Yes.
It's so heartbreakingly beautiful.
Yeah, it's heavy.
Incredible. Yeah.
Well, I love talking to you, Jim, and I'm glad we're—
You too, man, and we'll do it again. We'll do it again. I'm sorry we haven't hung before this, man. It's just, it's a great opportunity to kind of connect with people I admire. I love it.
Anytime when we're able to talk again, you can come over.
Is it still your garage?
It's a new garage, yeah.
New garage.
I'm in a new—
You've gone Jay Leno. You have 20 cars sitting there?
No, dude, it's like
200 cars?
No, but I had to make it into a little house. I got one car, and this garage is now like a little house next to my house.
I'm very lo-fi myself, man. Yeah. Stuff does not turn me on.
I don't.
You know, at one point, I got the Mercedes McLaren, and I just got tired of getting flipped off by people.
Yeah. I got what I thought was a nice car. I got a Toyota Avalon. I'm like, this is a little too nice for me. Yeah. But
well, it's fantastic talking to you, man. Really lovely.
Great work with the book, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you.
Okay, buddy.
Bye.
That was interesting. I think I did all right. He called me after, and we had a nice chat. Stand up guy, that Jim Carrey. And again, the book, co-written by Dana Vachon with Jim, is Memoirs and Misinformation, a novel. You can get that wherever you get your books. And that's what's happening, man. That's what's happening. Okay? Congratulations, everybody. You did it. Another day. Here's some dirty blues guitar.